It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite teabagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar, and what a show we have lined up for you today. We're going to be kicking off with David Limbaugh, the author of Crimes Against Liberty, a book that sat at number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 weeks, remained an additional 2 weeks at number two, and is still on the extended bestsellers list with the New York Times. In addition to that, we have Dinesh D'Souza, the author of The Roots of Obama's Rage. He's had books on the New York Times list himself numerous times. And finally, we will finish the show up with a brief remote live from the Tea Party Express, which I believe is pulling into New Mexico this morning, if my notes are correct. And we'll be speaking with Politic, the Tea Party rapper who raps for God. By the way, Politic will be on next week with a full guest segment, so we're looking forward to having him on next week and sharing a little of his music with you. For those of you that were tuning in to hear Douglas Schoen, the co-author of Mad as Hell, due to a scheduling conflict, Mr. Schoen has had to reschedule, but we believe we will have him back as soon as next week. So, with that being said, let's get right to our first guest. David Limbaugh is a lawyer, a nationally syndicated columnist with Creators Syndicate. He's a political commentator and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, including Absolute Power, Persecution, and Bankrupt. He is the brother of radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, and most recently, the very successful author who penned Crimes Against Liberty, an indictment of President Barack Obama. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Oh, absolutely, David. You know, I think it was fitting that at the beginning of the book you began talking about Obama the narcissist. I just had David Capellian on last week, who wrote the book, The Marketing of Evil, and he mentioned during the segment that he has talked to forensic psychiatrists who feel that, and as you point out in your book as well, that not only is Barack Obama a narcissist, but that he actually has narcissistic personality disorder, which may actually cross the border into a malignant narcissistic personality disorder. And you address this actually in a lot more detail in your book. Talk to us about Obama the narcissist. What evidence do we have that we're not just talking about somebody who's a little vain, but somebody who may actually cross the line into a clinical disorder?
Well, if you look at the various traits of a narcissist, and I think I listed nine of them in Chapter 1 from the psychiatric manual, he qualifies. I mean, they say if you have 5 out of 9, and he probably has 8 or 9 out of 9. He's the kind of guy that is not just the one that looks in the mirror and is self-absorbed in that sense, but he's thin-skinned, has a kind of a grandiose idea of his own importance, cannot stand anyone to disagree with him, and he reacts hostily when that occurs. And, you know, we saw evidence of this. We've seen evidence of this, for example, even as recently as when he was giving one of his speeches, and he claimed that they treat me like a dog. And of course, in that very speech, he was once again treating former President Bush, like a dog, blaming him for everything that he's now responsible for. Obama never taking ownership. Obama's the kind of guy that has a grandiose vision, a messianic complex. He thinks that he can cause the oceans to subside and the climate to change, and that he can bring about fundamental change to America. And that's why I think that he has a more acute case of it than Bill Clinton, who wanted to just be loved and adored and remain popular in the polls. Obama would rather be a transformative president, one-term president, than a mediocre, in his terms, two-term president. So he's willing not to serve a second term if he can really transform America, and that means, you know, convert it into the socialist utopian state of his dreams. And that's why I think he's dangerous. He has a dogmatic, extremist, leftist ideology coupled with his narcissism and his messianic complex, and he's not going to let the public will get in the way of his agenda. And we see it over and over, cramming Obamacare through despite the express will of the American people to the contrary. When he goes down in the polls, when he's on the eve of being shellacked electorally in the upcoming national congressional electorate, instead of saying, "I understand, I hear you, I'm going to mend my ways," he says, "I think you all are acting irrationally out of fear of economic circumstances born of policies that I inherited and didn't cause." I mean, it's all bundled. It's always all together. You've got elements of his instability throughout, or his psychological issues throughout. He can't take ownership and accountability for the problems he caused, even though he didn't. The prescriptions that he told us would work and keep unemployment below 8%, i.e. the $868 billion stimulus package, when it didn't work, he just says the problem was worse than he thought. It's still Bush's fault. And now he wants $50 billion more, about 1/17 the amount, to do what 17 times that amount wouldn't do. And he expects us to just casually and passively accept this as we ride in on our pumpkin trucks.
I like the pumpkin truck remark because one of the trademarks of this administration, as I see it, David, is anytime a policy is unpopular, the lack of popularity is blamed on the stupidity of the American people. And you hear comments coming out of Obama and people in his administration that essentially we just need to do a better job of communicating to the people, or in most cases they say educating the people, as if we're not educated enough to understand the policy, because if we were, we would certainly praise Obama, you know, for the policy.
Yeah, but he took it a step further here. He said we were irrational and not just dumb. Now we're irrational, and you know, in the book I talk about how Valerie Jarrett, is one of his key confidants, has said that he has the burden of being too bright. He's just too sharp, and it's hard for him to relate to people. I saw how hard it was for him to relate to Doris, who asked him a question about health care and the egregious taxes it would usher in some forum, and he spent 2,600 words rambling and never addressing her point and appearing about as verbally incompetent as is possible to appear. And we're supposed to believe that off teleprompter he's a genius. Well, I'm not buying it.
Well, I'm not buying it either, and I want to run a couple things by you, and then I'd like to ask you what you think the response would have been if Dan Quayle, Sarah Palin, or George W. Bush had done these things. Of course, now everyone knows that at one point he said that he had been to 57 states. He said that John McCain was running for George Bush's fourth term. He suggested that he actually stated that America invented the automobile. And in what had to be one of the worst demonstrations of mathematics on the part of any president, I think he suggested, and hopefully I don't have the exact number wrong, but he suggested that the health care bill would cause employers to have their premiums go down by something like 3,800%, having no knowledge of the fact that once you had a 100% reduction, health care would be free. On top of that, he said that when Russia put the missiles in Cuba, that Kennedy, you know, flew to meet with Khrushchev and got those missiles out of there. Obviously, Khrushchev put the missiles in Cuba after he had met with Kennedy. And he claimed that he's here, he's on the planet, he was born because some people marched across a bridge, you know, from Selma, Alabama. And actually, he was born 4 years before the march. So all these things demonstrating a lack of history knowledge, a lack of mathematic knowledge, and yet he's still praised as an intellectual. What's your take on how the press would have responded if any of those things had been said by George W. Bush, Dan Quayle, or Sarah Palin, or perhaps their most recent favorite target, Christine O'Donnell?
We really don't need to waste any time, valuable airtime, even discussing it. It's so self-evidently true, the double standard that the media would have applied. They wrote books about George Bush being an idiot, Ronald Reagan being an amiable dunce, even though, by the way, most recently, Christiane Amanpour on This Week with George Steffi Stephanopoulos said that she longed for the days of intellectual conservatism of Bill Buckley and Ronald Reagan. Now, of course, Bill Buckley they thought was an intellectual, but Ronald Reagan they thought was bedtime for Bonzo Moron. And It's only when his writings later came out and showed what a brilliant thinker he was that they've had to give some ground on that, but they still don't in their private quarters. They think anyone that is ultimately conservative is either evil or stupid. They knew that Buckley wasn't stupid, so they probably thought he was evil, and then they thought he was softening in his later years anyway. But the double standard is remarkable, and Dan Quayle, because he commits some verbal faux pas or stumbles around sometimes, was considered stupid. And by the way, he was nothing but, I mean, he was nothing of the sort. He was quite learned and knowledgeable, especially in certain areas of his expertise. He did have a manner that gave off that impression, just like Sarah Palin does sometimes. But people underestimate those people, in my opinion. There's a certain quirk about them that makes them appear, I think, less sophisticated or less intellectually adept. But I think it's misleading because I think they're both very smart. And Reagan was clearly smart, and even George W. Bush was smart, even though he kind of had a countercultural attitude toward intellectualism, and he was the cowboy type and was a tail fellow well met, but he was by no means stupid. His grades were far superior to Al Gore, and Al Gore has just been buffoonish as well and a complete liar about so many things. And you didn't mention a minute ago as to Obama that a lot of the things demonstrated a lack of intellect, but they also demonstrated dishonesty, fundamental dishonesty on some stuff. Because he claimed certain things happened that didn't happen, just like Hillary Clinton claiming she was named after Sir Edmund Hillary, when that timeline didn't work out for her either. I mean, where do these people come up with this stuff? I mean, why would they have to go to... He's already president of the United States. You think he needs to impress people anymore? But, you know, it just never... They're so self-absorbed that nothing's enough for them, I guess. But Obama, when he's off teleprompter, I just want to make one other comment. When he's off teleprompter, look what he did when he was talking about duplication and triplication and medical expenses. Well, I'm going to get these doctors in a room, and we'll get all three of them to talk about the x-rays, and they'll share the x-ray, and then they won't order two or three sets of the same thing, and that's how we'll save money. That was the most pathetically, painfully naive exchange I think I ever witnessed from a president. He's sitting there saying he doesn't understand how the medical system works, like the doctors are going to, they don't collaborate, and he some bureaucrat's going to get in the room with them, talk it over, just like he tells us when he goes to Notre Dame, we need to talk about abortion. We have a national dialogue on abortion. Well, we haven't had that, have we, for 50 years?
No.
37 years, 37, excuse me.
Let me just make a couple of quick comments about his lack of knowledge in the medical world. First of all, in one of his speeches, I mean, everybody knows that he mispronounced Corman twice in one sentence, but he also tends to mispronounce Alzheimer's. He tends to use the version Alzheimer's, which typically is something that sort of developed among people who didn't know how to say Alzheimer's. And
they thought it was old-timer's disease, you know?
Yes, Maybe he thinks that's it, but he seems to have a real lack of basic information about how medicine works. For instance, two of my favorite Obama stories regarding medicine.
Yeah, I stopped these. Go ahead.
Okay, but it's like, well, you take your daughter to the doctor and she's got a sore throat, and the doctor looks at his fee schedule and he sees that he can make more money doing a tonsillectomy than treating the sore throat, so he does a tonsillectomy. I mean, the same thing
with the diabetic. Instead of prescribing a diet, he orders the amputation of the foot, which will cost, according to the naive, painfully naive Obama, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. Now, I don't know which is more remarkable, that he thinks that doctors are that sadistic and hateful and evil, or that he is so naive about the problem. Nobody can discharge that. I mean, I've talked to doctors. It's woefully less. I mean, exponentially less fees for amputation. You know, this guy, but he just says stuff. He just wings stuff like he's been coddled all his life. He can just say all the stupid stuff he wants to on anything. You know, I really do think he's been shelved by people elevated artificially for various reasons. And he, as a result, he's been cloistered and has no idea what the real world's about. They talked about George Bush not understanding the the nuances of a cash register in a modern supermarket. And here we've got this guy that talks the way he does about medical technology and how he's, and this guy's the one now controlling the whole thing. This is frightening stuff. We got a combination of Mr. Magoo and Nicolai Machiavelli here. I mean, he's a guy that's just completely ignorant about basic things and yet completely manipulative about the Olympic process that he undertakes. He destroys our system.
Well, it's also interesting. He doesn't get that we have a system now to avoid litigation. And the family practitioner, upon seeing a young child with a sore throat, would, refer that child to a specialist if they needed a tonsillectomy. The doctor that would treat the sore throat.
Yeah, but the pediatrician doesn't even do it.
Right. And it's the same thing with the diabetic foot. And furthermore, amputating the foot doesn't preclude the need to treat the diabetes. You would still have to do that, so it's not really an either-or situation.
That's a good point. My dad died ultimately of diabetes, systemic failure as a result of diabetes, and you're exactly right. In fact, once they did amputate his foot, coincidentally, since we're talking about the same thing, he went downhill and died two weeks later. I mean, it's not like it's a cure-all. I mean, it's great for people, don't get me wrong, but still.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't reduce the diabetes. It just takes away some of the damage that's been done by the diabetes. And what I can tell you is that old Doc Johnson, now this might have been true 100 years ago, but in today's modern medical system, of which Barack Obama seems to be completely ignorant, old Doc Johnson isn't cutting off feet with a rusty saw in the back room.
I mean, it's
ridiculous. And so what I like – go ahead.
Well, I hadn't even thought about your further point. I hadn't followed through. I was so appalled at what he said about cutting the foot off that I hadn't even thought through it, and it's a great point you make, that it doesn't do anything at all. It puts a stop on the damage that you won't get gangrene through your system or whatever it is. The infection won't continue through your system when your foot has become atrophied or whatever, losing the blood, whatever happens to it, and kind of dies off. But he's acting like that cures the diabetes, and the diabetes is uncurable. I mean, it's treatable, so it remains after that. I hadn't thought about it. So how's he going to explain that one?
I don't know how he's going to explain that one. And so what I like to do is I like to make a little joke about Obama that, he already said – first he started with a sore throat that resulted in an unnecessary tonsillectomy. Then he went to a diabetic who got an unnecessary foot amputation. And I suppose the next thing he's going to say is, guy goes into a doctor's office, has a headache, doctor looks at his fee schedule, he can either give him an aspirin or do brain surgery. Yeah, he makes more money than
his
brain
head
surgery.
Off.
So he takes him in the back and he cuts his head off. Yeah, I mean, it's that nuts. It's that nuts, David. And nobody calls him on this.
It's just us, evil conservatives. you've got to know that some of these hoity-toity intellectuals up there have been appalled. Surely they've been appalled. They cannot be blind to – however, some of these guys are so steeped in their ideology that they think that not only is morality defined by the policies you advocate as opposed to how you conduct your personal life, so that if you advocate that we confiscate somebody else's wealth, you can be as cheap with your money as you want to be, and you're still the most moral guy in the world. They also seem to think intellect is defined by what policies you advocate. So you can be the biggest moron you want to be or can be, and you, as long as you advocate the proper policies, you're a genius, notwithstanding any stupid things you say.
Well, let's switch from intellect to sophistication, because one of the things we heard back in 2008 is, oh, my God, this Sarah Palin, she's this folksy woman from, Wasilla, Alaska, and she's just so unsophisticated. She didn't get a passport until she was 40. You can't get more unsophisticated than that. And then we start watching Barack Obama, and he makes comments like, people in Austria speak Austrian. Then he says that, the translators in Iraq, are using up resources. We need to take those translators and send them to Afghanistan, even though it's a different language. He chastised Americans for only knowing one language and then totally butchered trying to say the 4th of May, Cuatro de Mayo. He kept saying Cuatro de Cinco, which means four or five. He gave the queen an eye.
And
he gave the queen an iPod with a bunch of speeches on it, which kind of, you know, harkens back to the narcissism. But it also suggests an incredible naivete. Gordon Brown a bunch of DVDs that were formatted wrong for Europe. And I'm thinking, well, where's all this damn worldly sophistication? He was, you know, he grew up in Jakarta, and he was supposed to be this internationally sophisticated guy, yet he seems to be really ignorant on various languages. He doesn't know that it's inappropriate to give a cheap piece of electronics to a dignitary from another country. I don't see the sophistication. Am I missing something?
No. But I have to hit on one other thing, deviating a little bit from your point. It's not just that he gave the DVDs, his speeches to the British. It's that he didn't know how gauche that was. He didn't.
Exactly.
He's so self-absorbed. Now, I mean, that's an acute problem. When you don't realize, it's one thing to be so self-absorbed that you would want to give somebody something, brag on yourself, but not to understand how inappropriate that is means that he's so self-absorbed he doesn't even view the world rationally when it comes to him and his involvement in it.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this guy thought he could go. He's made an idiot out of himself in Copenhagen twice. The first time he went there thinking all he had to do was give a speech and Chicago would get the Olympics.
Yep.
And the second time he thought all he had to do was give a speech and worldwide cap and trade would become a deal.
Yeah, and by the way, he didn't have to undertake either of those. This Olympic thing, he put himself out. And that's another thing where he underestimated overestimated his own miracle ability. But, you know, he did the same thing with going to Notre Dame and thinking that his addressing the abortion issue, no less serious than a life or death matter, which has been roiling our society for 37 years since Roe versus Wade in 1973, he thinks he can go to Notre Dame and talk a little bit about it, and people will have a collective aha moment and say, I never realized the way he puts that. Yeah, I don't. Killing babies is not as big a deal as I thought it was, and we're going to all live happily ever after. Kumbaya. In fact, it cost the university some $8 million for their foolishness and stubbornness and leftist dogmatism in having him there. And similarly, when he goes to Cairo, he thinks that by some rhetorical magic, he can reunite the Muslim, the Arab world, and the United States, or the West, and bring us all together, when in fact, if you look at the polls now, after his coddling and sucking up to the Muslim world, that he's worse in the polls than Bush was. I didn't know they did polls on popularities of presidents over there, but apparently they do.
Well, I can't. I mean, I've always sort of subscribed to the speak softly and carry a big stick philosophy, and that's how you gain international respect. This guy thinks if he goes on a world apology tour and badmouths America, that suddenly everyone's going to love us. It's kind of like when the Dixie Chicks were overseas and they said they were, you know, ashamed of President Bush. I mean, let's just play to the crowd. It's amazing.
Well, you know,
go ahead.
Osama bin Laden was on record as having said that after he attacked us earlier in Mogadishu, the way we responded and turned tail and ran, we were a paper tiger, so that he anticipated that our response to 9/11 would be some meaningless volley of 70 cruise missiles like Clinton always did. And he was shocked when George Bush countered with a comprehensive war against terrorists and states that sponsor them. And so Obama wants to reverse that and says that now listen to his philosophy. He thinks that we cause terrorism. And think of where he was raised, Jeremiah Wright's church. Our chickens have come home to roost with 9/11, meaning we caused terrorists to attack us by our policies. Well, they don't hate us because of our policies. They hate us because we're infidels, according to them, and we're powerful infidels, and we got to either submit or be taken over. And be eradicated. But Obama, the irony of the left led by Obama on this policy toward Muslims is this. Can you think about how patronizing they treat Muslims? They say, on the one hand, that Muslims are just peaceful, loving people, and they're They're not a jihadist among them, and maybe one or two, a tenth of a percent might be jihadists. And yet, they say that if we even look at them the wrong way, they're a hair trigger away from mass murder. So they're all peaceful people. How dare you suggest otherwise? We'll fire Juan Williams if he just says he has that inner feeling. And yet, if anything happens, they'll all become jihadists. Now, which is it? Are they crazy lunatics waiting to go off? Are they just peaceful people? Now, the conservatives don't take that stupid position. We don't go around saying they're all jihadists. I mean, I don't think there's few smaller percentages as the liberals would like us to believe, but we don't go around acting like if we don't just coddle them every second of the day, they'll end up attacking us. If they're peaceful Muslims, they're peaceful Muslims. If they're jihadists, they're jihadists. You don't recruit them because you attend to your own national interests. That, you talk about naivete. So we're wrong to assert our own national interests as a sovereign nation? I'm so sick of this guy going around the world apologizing for us, saying we've been arrogant and dismissive and consumed too much of the world's resources and projecting our power. On page 323 of my book, I talk about how he laments being that we're still a world superpower. Well, I don't lament it. We have been the greatest force for good in the history of the world. When we defeat nations in war, we don't subjugate the people. We liberate them, and then we pay to rehabilitate them and rebuild their societies and their cities. So I am sick of him slamming America. I'm sick of his wife saying America's downright mean and she was never proud of it until he ascended to the throne. And so I think when Daniel Ortega slammed the United States for 50 minutes, Barack Obama should have walked out of the room or should have jumped back up to that podium and said, I resent you attacking my country. You're the tyrant. You're the brutal dictator. But instead, he and the people that he surrounds himself with glorifies these dictators, sucks up and coddles tyrants and dictators, and turns his back on true democratic movements such as in Iran and Honduras. Other than that, I think Obama's been a heck of a good president.
That was a joke. No, I rather assumed it was. Now, one of the things, getting back to his narcissism, has just been, you know, with all the talk about the color of his skin, it seems to me that what's most interesting about this guy is the thickness or lack thereof of his skin. Anybody that disagrees with this guy is attacked. That includes Fox News, Sarah Palin, your brother, the Tea Party. Anyone who disagrees with him comes under attack, and he just looks so unpresidential when he's doing it. But, I mean, talk to me about that. I mean, is this not unprecedented? I don't recall George W. Bush calling people out by name.
It's completely unprecedented, especially when this guy held himself out as being so civil and gracious and post-partisan and post-racial and post-grievance. He has been the most petty, vindictive chief executive we've ever had, at least in modern times, and anytime, as you said, he'll call out Jim Cramer, he'll call out Tea Partiers, and he attacks them personally. Think about how unpresidential and inappropriate it is for him to call bankers fat cat bankers, or to say that insurance companies are making obscene profits when, in fact, they're not making obscene profits. For him to say insurance companies are discriminating against those with pre-existing condition when, which is civil rights language, incendiary language designed to alienate insurance companies from the people. Well, you know, you're not discriminating when your contract says you're not supposed to cover pre-existing conditions, and when Obama knows that if they did cover pre-existing conditions, they wouldn't be insurers, they'd be public utilities, and they'd go bankrupt. And, in fact, we know that he was lying about this and unfairly castigating them when later he was trying to promote his mandatory coverage provision, and he said, we can't force insurance companies, we can't expect them to cover pre-existing conditions unless we have mandatory coverage because they'll go bankrupt. Well, he didn't say that before. He didn't say when he was slamming them for not covering pre-existing conditions, which their contract didn't require them to, that they would go bankrupt. It's a complete bully and completely unpresidential. Yes, and he attacks Bush all the time. By the way, contemptuously. It's not like he just casually says, well, this is Bush. If somebody opposes him, like Gerald Walton, I talk about in Chapter 11, the AmeriCorps Inspector General who uncovered corruption on the part of one of Obama's friends to the tune of $800,000, they had to pay almost half of it back in the St. Hope Charity Administration, a stimulus fund. And once Walton uncovered that, he didn't reward him as an inspector general and enhance his powers as a government watchdog. He fired him. He gave him one day to resign or be fired, even though the law requires 30 days and it requires he'd be given specificity of reasons. They fired him on one day, no notice, and didn't give him any reasons. And when he fought back, they then slandered him, saying that he was senile and incompetent, confused, didn't want to know what he was doing. And after they'd made those bogus allegations, they invited him to speak at a staff meeting of some 2,000 people, this same Walpin guy, on a subject of which required serious mental faculties and expertise and knowledge, after they'd accused him of being incompetent. So it was a complete smear, just like with Perella Weinberg, when they had the Chrysler restructuring after he'd taken over GM and Chrysler, and he proposed that the secured creditors who are supposed to get priority under the law were to get 29 cents on the dollar, and his union buddies who were unsecured were going to get 50 cents on the dollar, and Perella Weinberg and their lawyer, Tom Loria, objected, and he threatened to go public and say, you're a group of greedy speculators, and I'm going to ruin your reputation in public. He actually made those threats. And I documented in my book. One more thing, when Senator Kyle in Arizona sent a letter to Obama saying, you've spent too much stimulus money that didn't stimulate anything, why don't you put a freeze on that which has not yet been spent? And he says he has four of his cabinet members fire off simultaneous letters back and saying, if you are so smart about how we should spend the stimulus money, if you don't need it, well, we'll just withhold Arizona's portion of the stimulus money that hasn't been received yet, as if it's their money to withhold or distribute on a whim. And these are brutal dictators who are acting outside the rule of law and the Constitution. Structural instruments, an instrument whose framers understood that man, left to his own devices, would subjugate other men. And unless you establish a system of government pitting the branches and levels of government against each other, you couldn't keep men from subjugating other men. So it was a matter of establishing competing levels and branches of government to prevent power abuses. And so that when you upset that governmental structure that the Constitution establishes, you jeopardize our power structure, you jeopardize the checks and balances, and thus jeopardize the liberty that it guarantees. And that's what we see with judicial activism. It's not just Roe versus Wade that causes this pro-abortion mania to begin. It's not just the substantive issue. It's that the courts are not supposed to be making the laws. This was a matter to be decided by the states, by their duly elected legislators. And so when you let the government, when you let the unelected judiciary and unaccountable judiciary make the laws, then you lose some of that check. When the Congress and the president get together, when the president does end runs around Congress that won't pass a cap and trade despite the fact that it has 77 vote majority, Obama's so extreme they won't even pass his cap and trade, and so he has EPA declare carbon dioxide a toxic substance so he can issue new emission standards on his own from the Oval Office with no authority at all. That's what leads to tyranny, when you completely ignore the Constitution and nobody holds him accountable. Or he pledges $140 billion, 14% of $1 trillion, to the IMF for redistribution to third world countries. Third world countries, our money, when we're already bankrupt, when Congress expressly forbid him from doing it, and he said, I can do what I want in foreign policy because I'm commander-in-chief, I have plenary authority, which was a completely Orwellian argument because it was not foreign policy, it was foreign aid. So this guy does whatever he wants, and what you and I as constitutionalists are talking about is that when you ignore the kind of power restraints imposed by the Constitution, you threaten liberty, and that's what we're seeing today. The growth of government, there's an inverse relationship between the expansion of government and our individual liberties.
And, you know, it's amazing that Tea Partiers get that. You know, David, as I've been to numerous Tea Parties, I am amazed at the number of people who have fully read the Declaration of Independence, fully read the Constitution, fully read the Federalist Papers, and despite all the claims by the liberal media and liberal politicians that the Tea Partiers are just a bunch of stupid, angry, white racists, I find them to be very, very educated, particularly on the Constitution. And I think the Tea Party gets it, and the Democratic Party does not.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. That's the thing. They think we're walking around with green teeth out there and with our muskets and knuckles dragging the ground. And truthfully, it's a group of that is collectively very adept at governance and the Constitution and history. This has become a sophisticated populace partially because everybody's so motivated by the excesses that liberalism has wrought, and also because of the new media and the advent of the internet. And people are staying up, and it's got to be scary for these politicians that we know what they're doing, but almost before they do it now. And so even though they're still refusing direct accountability, ultimately they're being held accountable. At least we can hold our fingers, cross our fingers as we approach November 2nd.
Absolutely, and you led me right into my last question, and that was, I was going to say, I can't let you get out of here without making some sort of prediction. Everybody's accusing Dick Morris of being overly optimistic, but what are your predictions, Scott, your overall prediction as far as what's going to happen in the House and the Senate on November 2nd?
Well, you know, I hear that things are beginning to tighten, and if you notice, we've always heard that from the media, and you get that feeling in the air that things are starting to tighten, even when you're expecting a victory. And I am kind of on Morris's side on this, and not based on any empirical evidence. Mine is more of an intangible. I see the feeling in the air. I've been around, and I know people are scared. This isn't just the economy, stupid. Economies come and go, business cycles up and down. We are seeing a sustained suppression, a recession in our economy, by government action. He's exacerbated the economic problems through his failed Keynesian policies, and he's not learned his lesson. In fact, he's defiant about it. He's continuing to cram Obamacare down our throats. 65% of the people reject it. They're outraged. This is largely about America, stupid. It's about the national debt, about bankrupting America, not being able to bequeath to our kids the greatest, freest, most prosperous, most benevolent, most powerful nation in the history of the world. And people are fighting back to restore America to its founding ideals. And so I'm predicting that not only will we win the House, we have a very good chance to take back the Senate. Now, nobody can say with certainty whether we're actually going to do it, because ultimately these will fall down, or will be decided in a couple of races in the Senate. And, you know, Democrats are quite sophisticated at cheating, and I'll say that on the record. Everybody knows it. It's true, and there's not parity among Republicans and Democrats in cheating. You mentioned before about the chicanery that's going on in the polling booths, and they're now actually accusing conservatives and Republicans of cheating when this Justice Department will not even enforce voter intimidation that was flagrant and outright fraudulent in the Philadelphia case, because the alleged victims were white and the actors were black, and there's an unwritten policy at the Justice Department now saying that we have race-conscious justice and whites cannot be victims of black voter intimidation. So I say that we are ultimately going to probably take back both the House and the Senate. You cannot measure voter intensity. It is unquantifiable. None of the pollsters can know for sure who's ultimately going to go to the polls. Nor can you and I know how much Obama can motivate and antagonize his base. He's out there berating them now. Will that backfire? Will they get angry that they're already a little bit mad at him for being so, well, all different kinds of things, for being incompetent and for not being liberal enough? It's an amazing world we live in. So, I mean, there's a lot of wild cards out there, but I have to choose to be enduringly optimistic, because I can't allow myself to think of what will happen if we don't stop this guy in his tracks and begin to reverse some of the catastrophic disaster he's imposed on the country. So I really, it's almost like I can't afford not to be optimistic. So I choose to be.
And I am as well, and I think one of the, and let me get your one last opinion from you. Obviously, turnout is going to be key. We watched Glenn Beck draw hundreds of thousands of people to the mall in Washington, and then we watched 400 separate left-wing wacko organizations get together and try to outdo him, and you can just tell by looking at the aerial photography, they didn't even get half the crowd that he got. One man versus 400 liberal organizations. They were offered on their websites, the SEIU and various other groups, free bus rides to the event, and they couldn't even put together half of the people that Glenn Beck drew. I'm really hoping, and I'm sharing your optimism, and I'm hoping that's indicative of the lack of enthusiasm right now on the part of Democrats, on the part of the extreme liberals, and that we're going to see that type of enthusiasm gap translate into getting both the House and the Senate back. I'm going with Dick Morris, too. Let's hope we're all right.
Well, yeah, and then you've got the Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart who are going to try to do the same thing here coming up, and you hear stories that they're getting interest. I don't see it, but even if they do meet, they're going to get the activists, the diehards, and I don't think it'll be indicative of any counter tidal wave. I think this thing is going to be a tidal wave. So let's pray and let's be optimistic, because I really think we can do it.
Fantastic, David.
By the
I
way,
appreciate...
Mark, the real key is what happens after we do it, and that's where it becomes critical, because if we squander our stewardship, if Republicans don't toe the conservative line after they take power, back power, and they don't fight Obama instead of becoming squishy, and like Mitch McConnell is suggesting, that we're going to start compromise. If they start that again, then it, I think, will be ultimately the Tea Parties are saying, and we've had it, third party, and the Republican Party will be relegated to minority status, as it will well deserve. I mean, this is a critical juncture. It's not just about the election. It's what happens afterwards. And I'm not, you know, trying to count our chickens before they're hatched. But if we do win big, then the test begins.
I think Sean Hannity put it best when he said, you know, for all you Republicans that are about to be elected, understand you're going to be on probation.
Absolutely.
I love the way he put that. Once again, David, we went over. Thank you so much for your time and the extra time. The book is Crimes Against Liberty. For those of you listening right now, you need do nothing else other than look to the bottom of the page where we're going to have a link to Amazon, where you can buy David's book, Crimes Against Liberty. We'll also have some of his other bestsellers posted there as well. And would you like to give any direction as far as places they can go to get your books, David?
No, whatever, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, local bookstores, whatever. I appreciate the purchase. Everybody tells me, and this is humble, I'm not bragging, that they really think that it's the most comprehensive book out there, and it's well-written and easy to read. So I've been really gratified about that. It's gotten great reviews, and you know, it's humbling. It was number one on the New York Times list for 2 weeks, then number two, and it's still on the extended list after 8 weeks. But, and you know, if it doesn't sell another copy, I'm happy. But I think there's a lot of ammo there for people who want to know what happened, the historical record as it occurred, and the damage this guy's done. You will be amazed. It's all there.
Hey, I've got an idea. Don't just buy a copy for yourself. Buy a copy for a liberal and give it to him for Christmas.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Absolutely. Dave, thank you for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we hope to have you back again sometime soon.
It's been my pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me.
And now it's time for our next guest, Dinesh D'Souza. Many of you will recognize him from his many appearances on Fox News as well as other networks. He is the president of King's College in New York City. He's a former White House domestic policy analyst and research scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His best-selling books include Illiberal Education, The End of Racism, and What's So Great About America? His current bestseller is The Roots of Obama's Rage. It is a book that attempts to explain many of Obama's bizarre behaviors and many of his policy choices in light of his anti-colonialism upbringing. Please help me welcome to the show, Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be on.
I've got to tell you, I am one of those people that thought I had Barack Obama figured out. I thought, well, here's a guy that had one of the most liberal voting records in the U.S. Senate. You throw in a little civil rights activism, you know, perhaps mixed with some black liberation theology, and presto, you've got Barack Obama. But you point out that while these things may explain a little about Barack Obama, explain his behaviors in part, that there's a much stronger motivating force behind the scenes based on his upbringing. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's been a lot of speculation over the past couple of years about what motivates or what drives Barack Obama. And some of it is just pure guesswork. So, for example, Obama will come out and endorse the Ground Zero Mosque or call for jihadis who are captured in Iraq or Afghanistan to get constitutional rights or free legal representation. And people go, gee, why would an American president do that? Maybe he's some kind of a closet Muslim, for example. So I've been puzzling about what motivates Obama, and you know, then I picked up his book. This is Obama's autobiography, published in 1995, and even the title is kind of revealing. It's Dreams from My Father, and the book is all about how Obama gets his dreams and his aspirations and his values and even his very identity from his father. So right away I said, who was his father? It turns out his father was an anti-colonialist, a guy who grew up in Kenya when Kenya was fighting for independence from the British. And he had a whole fully developed ideology. Barack Obama Sr., Obama's dad, was an economist. And this ideology, when you look at it carefully, is eerily similar to what the younger Obama is doing in the White House. So the anti-colonial hypothesis, if you will, has a lot of explanatory power in illuminating what President Obama is doing both on the domestic front and on the international front.
So with as much talk as there's been about George W. Bush being motivated to finish the unfinished business of George Herbert Walker Bush, President Obama himself may very well be attempting to complete the unfinished business of his father.
That's a good way to put it, although remember in the case of George W. Bush, you know, there's absolutely no indication that Bush was embarked on such a path, whereas in Obama's case, he wrote a whole book. In fact, a lot of the people who are close to Obama have noticed an eerie similarity between Obama and his father in personality and in values. His grandmother, a woman named Sarah Obama, was quoted in Newsweek recently, and she said, "I look at him," meaning President Obama, "I look at him and I see all the same things. The son has taken everything from the father. The dreams of the father are being realized in the son." So it's not just Obama himself, it's the people close to Obama who have noticed that here is a guy very much, very self-consciously in his father's image.
Well, how did that happen, given the fact that Obama only met with his father once when he was 10 years old, and the next time he visited his father was actually deceased, and he had visited the graves. So how did this transfer of dreams take place?
Yeah, this is a story I tell in The Roots of Obama's Rage. Basically what happens is that even though the father is absent, Obama is kind of obsessed with the man who isn't there, if you will, and the mythic image of his father as a great hero, as a larger-than-life figure, this is cultivated in young Obama by his mother. Now, this seems odd in itself because the father abandoned the mother and young Obama, but nevertheless, she continued to think he was a great man. And even when Obama would complain to his mom and he would say, you know, gee, where's my dad? How come he's not here? And so on. The mother would scold him and say, oh, no, don't criticize him. Your father was the great man, the son of Africa, the liberator, and so on. And so Obama's mom, was the father's first convert, and she was the one who built up the father in Obama's mind. Later, Obama realized his father had a lot of flaws, but when he went to the father's grave and he wept, He rubbed his hand into the ground. He said, "Through Africa's red soil, I communed with my father." You know, it's all a little bit bizarre. The father had been dead, of course, for 6 years. And so Obama realized, I can't get my father back. So in effect, what he says is, I can't get my dad, so I'll take his dream. I'll take his vision. I'll take his ideology. And so what Obama did was he decided, my father may be a flawed man, but he had noble ideals. And it's the ideals that Obama decided to run with.
Well, when we talk about the dreams of Obama's father, essentially, you know, the anti-colonialism, obviously
Barack Obama cannot come out and shoot straight with the American people as to this being his underlying agenda. So he's essentially had to craft a public persona. He's had to build this. And he seems to have convinced the American people that the American civil rights struggle is his own. Am I off the mark with that?
Well, he certainly did that very successfully in the campaign. He was able to, in a sense, present his history as being the embodiment of American multiculturalism, as if he was the pure quintessential American with a history that was black and white, so to speak. In fact, Obama's history is not multicultural at all. His mom is, in fact, white with a European heritage, but Obama very self-consciously rejected that heritage. In fact, he describes in his book when he went to Europe, he said he hated it. It was beautiful, but he said, who cares? It's not my heritage. So even though his mom is white, and so he's half European, if you will, that to Obama is not the real him. It's only when he goes to Africa and reconnects with his relatives and goes to his grandfather's grave and his father's grave. This is really the way that Obama forms his identity. Now, interestingly, although Obama describes himself as African-American, he's really not. In America, to be African-American means to be descended at some point from slaves. That's the meaning of the term African-American. It's not a term defined purely by skin color because, you know, I'm an immigrant from India. I'm the same skin color as Obama, so obviously I'm not African-American. To be African-American, you need to be descended from slaves. Now, Obama isn't descended from slaves. His father was an educated immigrant from Kenya, and his mom was a white woman from Kansas. So, in some senses, I think Obama has had to, you might say, manufacture a little bit his racial identity so that he comes across, for political reasons, more as an African-American than what he really is, which is the descendant of foreign immigrants and a Midwestern white woman.
Well, one of the attempts at that, and by that I mean painting himself as a product of the civil rights movement and as an African American, was his now famous or infamous speech, depending on your point of view, in Selma, Alabama. It's a clip that I've played often on the air, and at the very end, he's saying, you know, I'm here because some people marched across a bridge in Selma, Alabama. And that was Barack Obama, you know, trying to show himself as someone who had taken the torch of that movement, as someone who was a product of that movement. But he basically was fibbing a little bit that day and kind of got caught from a historical standpoint in that lie.
Yeah, I mean, his father came. He pretended like he was funded by the airlift that was promoted by President Kennedy, even though Kennedy was elected in 1960, took office in 61, and Barack Obama Sr. arrived in Hawaii in America in 1959. So obviously, Obama's arrival preceded the Kennedy program. Even more seriously, I report in the book how Obama describes a riveting racial incident that happened to him allegedly when he was in Indonesia. He was thumbing through Life magazine and he came across a story about an American black man who was taking medical treatments and injections to lighten his skin. And Obama says this was a horrific discovery for him about the nature of American racism. He describes, you know, his body quivering and shaking and the sense of shock that went through him as he saw this article and so on. Well, journalists who have gone and looked at Life magazine through the archives have found that there was no such article ever published in Life magazine. So Obama said, well, maybe it was in Ebony or some other magazine, but no magazine has carried this this article. So, interestingly, my theory about Obama is that he is an anti-colonialist like his dad, and perhaps the leading anti-colonialist writer of the past half century is the Algerian writer Frantz Fanon. While thumbing through one of Fanon's books called Black Skin, White Masks, Fanon is writing about North African blacks who, he says, are trying too hard to imitate their colonizers, the French. And he says they want to talk French, they want to look French, they want to dress French, And then he goes, hey, I've even heard of one case of a guy who took chemical treatments and injections to lighten his skin. In other words, it's almost a word-for-word account of this so-called racial incident that Obama described as happening to an American black man and him discovering it in Life magazine. It looks now like he lifted the anecdote from Frantz Fanon's book. Frantz Fanon was writing about North Africa, and Obama sort of applied the experience to himself. So my point is there seems to be a lot of fakery in Obama's sort of public self-presentation. He wouldn't be the first politician to make stuff up, but the fact that he does it so dramatically and describes his own emotional reaction, I mean, there's something deeply inauthentic and bogus about all this. And I think it shows us that the public Obama is not the real Obama.
Well, he's taken a number of steps to craft his public image, and certainly a lot of people buy into it. But with the time that we have left, I'd like to kind of dive into how this anti-colonial mentality that Obama has is affecting U.S. policy. And I guess in order to understand that, we need to distinguish between colonialism and neocolonialism.
Well, the basic idea of anti-colonialism is that the world is divided into two groups. There are the oppressors, there are the colonizers, and that's the white West, now America. And then there are the colonized. They are the victims. They are the poor people of the third world, of Asia, Africa, the Middle East, South America. And the basic idea here is that the rich countries got rich, not by being more productive or not by having a scientific revolution or an industrial revolution, but they got rich by invading and occupying and looting the poor countries. And that within the rich countries, you have these concentrations of economic elites, banks, pharmaceutical companies, oil companies, and so on. And this is sometimes called neocolonialism. It's the economic wing of colonialism. So the anti-colonialist wants to fight on two fronts. He wants to, on the one hand, bring down these economic elites. And one way to do that is to extend the power of the state, of the federal government, to control these aspects of the private sector. And then second, on the international front, to sort of lasso or scale back the rogue elephant that is America from stampeding and invading countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. So when you apply the anti-colonial formula, you see right away, hey, this seems to describe exactly what Obama is doing in domestic policy, and hey, it seems to describe exactly what Obama is doing in foreign policy. Why else would Obama take these so-called apology tours around the world where he goes to third world dictators, the United Nations, even Europe, and basically tell them, hey, help me put the leash on America. We don't want America to be this unilateral, rogue nation. Help me to control America. And all of this makes sense under the anti-colonial paradigm.
Well, it's interesting that we've never seen a U.S. president go on an apology tour like this. This is a guy that's referred to America as being arrogant. I think it's a situation where when you look at different things that he's done that you point out in your book, like, you know, scrapping the missile defense system in Poland and Czechoslovakia, for example, and then getting absolutely nothing in return from the Russians on it, to the way he's treating terrorists as criminals, as if they had robbed a bank or something in the United States. This anti-colonialism is easily readable once it's pointed out in both his national security policies as well as, more specifically, his war on terror or the lack thereof. You point out in the book that he even goes as far as to instruct his people not to use the term war on terror, which I find amazing.
Right. He seems to think, you know, I think the reason Obama does that is that in his mind, since America is the colonial or neo-colonial nation that is occupying two Muslim countries, namely Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, first of all, this explains Obama's zeal in trying to get us out of there, no matter what. Just this week it's come out that the Obama administration has been encouraging talks between Karzai, the Afghan prime minister, and the Taliban. to negotiate some kind of a settlement. This is not an initiative Karzai has been undertaking on his own. Obama's behind it. Now, again, why would a president encourage, you know, one may say, our own ally to be, in a sense, engaging in secret negotiations with the enemy? It makes sense if you think that Obama's main goal is to withdraw American troops, and he doesn't particularly care what happens over there. Karzai government, Taliban government, some mix of the two, you know, that's a secondary matter for Obama. Withdrawal to him is his definition of success. So when Obama views America as occupying these other countries, it almost seems that the Muslims who are fighting against America become anti-colonial freedom fighters. And so for Obama, if he describes this as a war on terror, then he kind of has to say that the Muslims are the good guys because they're fighting American occupation, American colonialism. And I think that's why Obama is so eager to redefine this war. It's not a war, according to him. The terrorists aren't soldiers fighting on an enemy side. Rather, they are just outlaws, kind of like somebody who might hold up a grocery store or a bank. And Obama's perfectly happy to say, okay, well, let's let the cops kind of go get them, and let's give them, if you will, normal criminal trials, not military court-martials, but normal criminal trials. So I think this is all an elaborate exercise for Obama to sort of justify, how can you go after these guys if, in the anti-colonial framework, they are the good guys?
But he's really sort of stepped in it, if you will, from a political standpoint, because part of his campaign message was the real war isn't in Iraq, it's in Afghanistan. So he was the one who placed the emphasis on victory in Afghanistan, but then he attempts to do that begrudgingly raising the troop level while at the same time announcing the official pullout date.
Exactly. I think that, Obama's endorsement of the Afghan war in retrospect appears to have been purely tactical, which is to say political. He didn't want to come out against both wars. He's made some stunning comments about the U.S. role in Afghanistan, where bombing villages, killing civilians, and so on, even though the U.S. military goes out of its way not to harm civilians. It takes great measures to minimize civilian casualties and focus on very targeted strikes against enemy targets. But nevertheless, Obama treats America as though we are just indiscriminately bombing villages. And this is supposedly for a war that he supports. When General McChrystal, Obama's then top general, went in to present him with a plan for victory, a counterinsurgency plan that he said, you know, it's difficult over there, but this might work. The McChrystal people said Obama seemed just bored. He seemed disengaged. He didn't care. And, of course, you plug in the anti-colonial model, and it makes perfect sense that Obama was bored, and he didn't want to hear about the victory plan because he doesn't want to win. To him, if America wins in Afghanistan, if we win in Iraq, it's only going to feed our imperial arrogance. It's only going to make us more eager to invade other countries from this anti-colonial viewpoint. So much better that we don't have the victory lap, the victory celebration. Much better that we leave with our tail between our legs, as in Vietnam, because that means we're not going to undertake any more imperial adventures in the future.
Now, I mentioned to you right before we went live that this book was a real eye-opener for me. I thought I had Obama figured out. It's obvious that I, like many people, did not have him figured out. But reading your book helped me understand something. And just to make sure I've got it, I want to run this by you. One of the things that has always puzzled me is a comment Barack Obama made during his campaign in 2008 that America needed a civilian peacekeeping force that was as large and as well-funded as the United States military. And this kind of surprised me. I kept thinking things like, well, why doesn't he just, you know, appropriate, why doesn't he say he would appropriate money to increase the police force? And when you consider what a large portion the military budget is of the United States budget, why would he want to impose this kind of cost on America? But if I'm getting everything correctly in your book, when you view this within the context of transferring power, and within the context of neocolonialism and transferring power from the colonizers to the colonized, this makes perfect sense.
Right. I think, you know, a lot of Democrats want to see redistribution within America. They'd like to see some money confiscated from the rich to give it to the middle class and the poor. But what they don't realize is that Obama is trying to produce redistribution on a global scale. He wants to enrich the formerly colonized countries, and he wants the money to come from what he sees as the oppressive colonizers. So, for example, he's been blocking oil drilling in America while he's been encouraging it in Mexico and subsidizing it in Brazil. And the Brazilians are selling some of that oil to the Chinese. Similarly, on the global scale, I think Obama thinks it's very bad that America is the world's sole superpower, because that's going to make us arrogant, it's going to make us a bully. So what's he trying to do? I think what he's trying to do is knock us off our pedestal. He wants us to be a normal country like Finland or Greece. And that's a scary prospect because, you know, this is America's moment. Ever since the end of the Cold War, we are the world's sole superpower. Honestly, no country that has ever lost that position has ever regained it. If you think historically to the Romans, or even, you know, people used to say the sun will never set on the British Empire. Well, it eventually did, and the British have never come back, and I don't think they will. So this is America's moment, and it's a rather scary thought that we have a president who is trying to bring that moment to a quick and abrupt end.
And before the British Empire, all roads led to Rome. And you're right, neither have we gained that. Whenever I do this show, there's almost always some reference to global warming. We've had a lot of global warming skeptics on, from Lord Christopher Monckton to Patrick Michaels to Chris Horner, Brian Sussman. And what you pointed out in your book was kind of interesting to me, because I had personally thought that Al Gore had convinced Barack Obama that anthropogenic global warming was in fact real. But as you point out in your book, as far as Obama's concerned, it really doesn't matter whether it's real or not, whether or not it's a legitimate threat to planet Earth or not, because going along with this global warming agenda is allowing him to accomplish goals, within his anti-colonialism.
Right. The anti-colonial idea is to realign America in the world. To do that, Obama looks for every possible pretext. You're quite right when you said earlier, he can't possibly come to the American people and say, listen, my dreams are the dreams of a Luo tribesman from Kenya in the 1950s. You know, this dead man, this African socialist, this polygamist, this chronic drunk driver who, killed a man and had so many accidents that his own legs had to be cut off and replaced with iron rods. This man is now the inspiration for the agenda and the dreams that I'm carrying out through policies in the White House. Obama couldn't possibly say that, so what he has to do is opportunistically look for occasions and events and say things like, I dream of a world free of nuclear weapons, or, hey, the globe has a fever, global warming, and therefore we need all these carbon taxes and so on. Of course, when it comes to third world countries, he doesn't want to have taxes on them. So then he goes, okay, well, let's give them a bunch of our money so that they can develop energy sources in an environmentally safe way. So the bottom line of it is that this is all, I think Obama personally doesn't know and could care less whether the earth is getting hotter or colder. It to him is a way, an opportunity, to transfer wealth substantially from the West and from America to what the anti-colonial writer Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth.
Well, I hear the terms global warming and global governance used together so often. I think we can understand how this would fit into Obama's overall plan. Now, as I interview authors, one of the things I always like to ask them after reading their books, where problems are often so accurately pinpointed, is what's the solution? Is it as simple to vote him out in 2012? Is that the only solution, or is there something we can do between now and then?
Well, in the short term, I think it's really important to sort of tie up Obama. One of the things to me that's very alarming and tragic is the fact that the normal system of checks and balances you know, in which, for example, there's a vigorous media that is holding Obama to account. I mean, that's just evaporated. The mainstream media, many of them are sort of writing press releases, in effect, for the Obama campaign. I was just interviewed on C-SPAN by a journalist, Jonathan Alter, from Newsweek, and this guy sounded like he was basically in the pay of the Obama administration. I mean, a complete flack, not one ounce of critical assessment toward Obama whatsoever. Had Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, been the one interviewing me, it would have made no difference. So the media has, in a sense, abdicated its responsibilities. And so for this reason, I see no alternative but to have a lot more Republicans elected who can at least be a break, a check on Obama. Now, you're right. It's going to be important to see what Obama does over the next couple of years. Will he change? Some people think maybe, like Clinton, he could move to the center. I personally don't think he will. Clinton was fundamentally a non-ideological guy. And when he realized that the wind had shifted, he's happy to move his boat in that direction. Obama, I think, has this anti-colonial ideology deeply imprinted on his psyche from a young age. So I don't think he's going to – I mean, he can duck and weave, as every politician does, but a fundamental shift of direction, I just don't see it.
Do you think that we've already gotten a hint that that is, in fact, the case by his statement that cap and trade will be a priority next year for his administration?
This is what I mean. I think he's a little bit like the toy soldier. Even when he walks into the wall, he keeps going. So, you know, I would urge listeners to pick up The Roots of Obama's Rage, because what it is it's a kind of a thrilling personal story about Obama and a very sort of truncated and almost deformed psychological family life that is his background, how that had a huge impact on him, and what a close connection there is between his father's ideas and Obama's actual policies.
If I read the book, I just kept thinking, is this the classic psychological case of a child who's been abandoned by his father, a child who blames himself for his father's departure, and a child who feels that by carrying out his father's wishes and being what his father would want him to be, that in some sense that he will get his father back?
You know, I think those psychological, those Freudian elements are powerfully present, and that's what makes this such a fascinating story. It would be a fascinating story if it was fiction, if it was written about somebody who was, you know, unimportant, but it just so happens that the somebody being written about is the President of the United States, and that's what gives this, I think, makes this kind of an electrifying combination of both a personal book but also a policy book, because not only does it enable you to account for, to explain what Obama's doing, even little stuff, why he would move a Churchill bust out of the White House, you know, why he wants NASA, the space agency, to become an outreach program for Muslims. So the anti-colonial theory can explain it. Even, and I think even more interesting, it can enable us to predict what Obama's going to do in the future.
Well, for those who would like to pick up a copy of the book, as you're listening to the show, at the bottom of the page, there is a picture of the book cover, and you can click on that and be directly transported to Amazon.com, where you can purchase the book. But I'm sure there are some other ways as well. Dinesh, why don't you tell us what those are?
Well, it's available online. My website is DineshDeSouza.com, DineshDSouza.com. By the way, I'm also president of the King's College in New York City, and that website is TKC, the King's College, tkc.edu. So those are ways to find out more about my work in general. And the book, of course, is available. It's one of the top-selling books in the country. It's widely available in bookstores or online.
I was in a Barnes & Noble just this weekend and saw that it had very prominent placement right when you walked in the door. So obviously they're putting one of their big sellers up front. Congratulations on the success of this book. With all that has been written about Barack Obama, I think this is certainly the most unique take and the one that seems to explain most of his behavior. While there may be some explanation that comes from black liberation theology or his liberal political roots, this seems to really nail it on the head and help explain the motivation behind many of Barack Obama's behaviors and policies that many of us find bizarre. Dinesh, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being here today. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm hoping that everyone listening right now will run out and grab a copy of this book.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And we're back live, where we're about to check in with the Tea Party Express in New Mexico. We're going to be giving David Saucedo, a.k.a. Politique, the Tea Party rapper, a call. Let's see if we can get a hold of David. Hello? Do we have Politique on the line?
Yes, sir.
Politique, this is Mark Galar with the Tea Party Power Hour. How are things going on the Tea Party Express today?
We're actually pulling into, we're not pulling in just yet, but we're on our way to Las Cruces, New Mexico for our first rally of the morning.
How many rallies do you guys have a day?
Something's happening here.
I know,
you
I
there?
Can hear it. Yeah, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I'm not sure what that was, but we'll just assume that that was a nervous liberal listening in on the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead. How many programs do you guys do a day?
Well, it depends. You know, just depending on the organizer locally. You know, some in each state. And then the Tea Party Express, how they organize. We can have one to two. On the last tour, we actually had three stops on a few of the days. But we've done two stops a day on this tour so far, and I don't think we're going to do a whole lot of them, if any at all, that have more than two stops.
Gotcha.
And one day.
Give the people listening an idea as to the type of people they might see in terms of speakers and entertainers when they come out and attend a Tea Party Express rally.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because we've had Sarah Palin at a couple of our stops already. We've had Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Arizona. We have a lot of – we had Newt Gingrich the other – I think that was yesterday – and in Waco, Texas, tomorrow at 4 p.m., we will have Governor Rick Perry opening up with our show. We'll have a great show planned for 4:30 p.m. in Waco.
Fantastic.
So
we have a great show planned for next week. We're going to have Jerome Corsi, who wrote Abomination. We've rescheduled Doug Schoen, the author of Mad as Hell, How the Tea Party Movement is Fundamentally Remaking Our Two-Party System. In addition to that, we've got a very popular young new rapper called Politique. Have you heard of that guy?
Politique,
if you, I'm just giving you a hard time, but the bottom line is that I caught your act in College Station, Texas. I thought it was phenomenal. You're undoubtedly bringing a whole lot of new blood into the Tea Party movement in the way of young people. And next week, I really, really, when we have a full segment, would like to get into your work as a youth minister, as well as how Christ turned your life around, and now how you're doing Christ's work within the Tea Party movement.
Well, I'm very excited about it. You know, I met you there in College Station, and I'm geared towards it, man. You are a local activist. I know you're on the radio, your show here, but it's important, man. Everybody who has any kind of voice at all, they're speaking out today, and you're one of those people. And so I just love supporting hometown people. We're fellow Central Texans, and I look forward to the show, man. We're gonna learn a lot about each other.
Absolutely, and we're gonna have a lot of your music keyed up and ready to go next week. We'll probably play some of it in its entirety, and we want to hear all about you. So we're gonna invite listeners to one, go out and and attend those Tea Party Express rallies when they come through your town, especially Waco, Texas. Listen up. They're going to be there. I guess it'll be next. Is it next Saturday morning that the Waco rally is taking place?
No, no.
Or next Saturday evening?
It's tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
Tomorrow,
okay. My mistake.
Sunday afternoon, tomorrow, we will have Governor Perry, myself. You know, it's almost it's a little over a year since I was noticed by the Tea Party Express. So this is kind of like a homecoming for me. Even though I've been home, this is like a homecoming with the Express. And it just so happens that we have a huge rally scheduled for 4:30 p.m. at the Hall Creek Ice House off of Highway 6.
Fantastic.
In Waco, Texas.
I hope you guys draw a phenomenal crowd. We're gonna need the Tea Party Express's help in defeating Democratic Congressman Chet Edwards, and that, of course, is half of the key battleground. Bryan College Station is a big chunk of that, and you know Waco is the other half of that. So anything you guys can do, go ahead.
We'll have Bill Flores there speaking as well. Right before that, he's going to speak at the Express rally, and then he's going to go to the debate with Chet Edwards. So hopefully he can go in there with Mr. Edwards and say, well, there's about 10,000 people out there that don't agree with you. You know, I mean, you know, I'm really excited. I'm like on this tour bus.
I understand your thoughts completely on that. I mean, I'm almost giddy with excitement. I keep trying to heed Sean Hannity's warning not to get too excited, but I find myself, and I know you're at the Tea Party Express right now, so you didn't get a chance to listen, but we had Rush Limbaugh's brother David on just a few minutes ago, and David has said that he is siding with Dick Morris and that he thinks we have an excellent chance to get not only the House but the Senate as well. So let's hope that happens. But I want to thank you for coming on and giving us this remote broadcast today. And I look forward to having a full segment, including a whole lot of your music, as well as we'll have some of your CDs on the website where people will just be able to click on them and order them, hopefully. And we'll talk with you later about that. But Politic, thank you so much for being on the show today. And we look forward to having a full-blown segment where we can educate our listeners as to what you and your music are all about next week.
Well, thank you so much, man. Everybody keep fighting, keep active, you know, keep active, and even after November 2nd, man, stay the course, and let's continue taking this country in the right direction. God bless you, man.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, David. Have a great day.
You too.
And that is it for our show today. Next week, as I said, we're going to have Jerome Corsi, the author of the best-selling book, Obama Nation, Leftist Politics and the Cult of Personality. We have rescheduled Douglas Schoen, the co-author of Mad as Hell, How the Tea Party Movement is Fundamentally Remaking Our Two-Party System. And we're going to have Politic, the Tea Party rapper, a young man who is a youth minister. He has turned his life around, found Jesus Christ, and now feels that his work for Christ involves his efforts within the Tea Party movement. So please join us next Saturday at 10 a.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. From the right, where we're usually right, I'm Mark Gillar.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.